How does it feel when your heritage isn't listed as an option on an identification form? What's it like to grow up as the only person in your family who looks like you? Where do you belong if you are simultaneously seen as being too much of one race and not enough of another to fit neatly into the expectations of society? It's a subject tackled in the book Mixed Stroke Other Explorations of Multiraciality in Modern Britain. It's by Natalie Morris. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. Natalie herself. Natalie, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning.
Good to have you with us. It's a fascinating subject, isn't it? Because there's been a sea change in the way that we look at the mix of races or perception of beauty, something that you discovered when you moved from your native Manchester, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really important point to raise. Because I grew up in Manchester and then moved to London in kind of my early 20s. And it was quite a stark difference in kind of how beauty standards were perceived. And I really noticed that, you know, the things about the way I looked that, you know, I tried to hide or minimize when I was younger suddenly kind of became in vogue when I was in my 20s and moved to London and moved to a more, you know, diverse area as well. And I think that is, you know, there is something to be said about the way that mixed kind of features are fetishized and, you know, kind of pedestalized in this kind of, you know, overarching way at the moment.
Because, I mean, it's a thing that was happening in Britain, happening all around the world. As, you know, as people travel around the world, they meet, they fall in love. You know, love has no colour, no creed, whatever. So people, I mean, it's hardly the same, but I'm half Scottish, half Welsh. But obviously that doesn't have an effect on my physical outlook, as it were. But we're getting, you know, lots of people coming from Sri Lanka, lots of people from India, et cetera, et cetera. One thing that you've pointed out is that perhaps there's a sliding scale, which is quite disturbing, of acceptability and trendability, if you like, about what the mix is.
Yeah, I think that's very true, and you pointed out a really important point there, because I think there's a tendency to see being mixed race or mixedness as one thing, as though it's kind of you're part black and part white. But as you alluded to there, it's so much broader than that. Particularly at the moment, there's so much more movement, there's so much more interracial relationships. And so to be mixed isn't just to be one thing. You can be mixed if you're Asian and white, black and white. And whiteness doesn't always have to be in the equation at all. There's lots of people who are black and Asian, and there are lots of conversations to be had about that kind of relationship as well. So I do think there is a sliding scale, and that kind of sense of being a trend definitely relates to how close you are to whiteness. So I often find that, you know, if you look a certain way when you're mixed, it's often the features that position you closer to whiteness that make people tell you that you're attractive. For example, if you have lighter skin, looser hair colours that are curly, it's kind of a way of being other, but not too other. So you're kind of more palatable in a way. And that's something that I've found a lot in my own personal experience and a lot with the people that I spoke to for the book as well.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because it's that pigmentation thing again, is it? Somebody like, you know, because Kardashians opened that up, and they're Persian stroke. I can't remember the second makeup, but I remember, you know, somebody like Beyonce, for example, is seen as a beautiful, you know, African-American woman, but she is very, very close to, I'm trying to get the right words to this, because, you know, I'm in my 50s, and when I grew up, we didn't call it mixed, we called it something else, which is now completely, and it began with half, and the other, I've got a very good friend who is Nigerian-British, and I used that, and she looked at me and said, well, that's just your generation, she's considerably younger than me. You know, the language has changed in the way we deal with this, and obviously this is it a problem? Do you find that people are, you know, well, it's a two-way thing. In one respect, people are people, you know, in the black community, has there been a move to try and lighten their skin? And on the other side, are you seeing, if you like, you know, Europeans trying to act more street, and by street they mean appropriating sort of, you know, Afro-Caribbean or culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. I think what you're getting at is this idea of colorism, and that is the kind of specific form of racism that exists often within minority communities that privileges people who have lighter skin. So, for example, you mentioned Beyonce there, so she's a light-skinned black woman, and that gives her a lot more privilege and access to certain spaces than darker-skinned black women and darker-skinned monoracial people, so people who are black, for example, as opposed to mixed with black. And I think that's a really important thing to look at. And colorism is a really pervasive and dangerous feature of kind of a system that's based on white supremacy, where whiteness will always be the pinnacle, that will always be at the top, and everybody else comes underneath, with blackness always at the bottom. And that means that people who are mixed are kind of in the middle of this sliding scale, where colorism is playing a big part in the level of privilege and access that we have in the world. But at the same time as that, you also, as a non-white person, as somebody with black heritage or Asian heritage, you are seen as other still. So you're still experiencing microaggression, racism, oppression, at the same time as having more privilege than people who have darker skin than you. So that's where it comes into this sliding scale. And that's why it can be, you know, an interesting space to be in, and quite, you know, often quite difficult to navigate when you are mixed and you're trying to hold both of these things within you at the same time, really.
As a mixed race person, and if you don't mind me asking, I'm struggling for the words to say. Put this politely, if you like, Natalie. But yeah. You know, what is the I mean, I'm, like I said before, Celtic, half Scottish, half Welsh. Yeah. What's your mix, as it were?
So my parents, my dad has Jamaican parents, so he's black Caribbean, and my mum is white British. So I am actually, that is the most common mix of ethnicities in the UK. So if you look at a kind of like a blueprint almost of mixedness, of what the mainstream understanding of mixedness is, it's somebody who looks like me or somebody who looks like Meghan Markle, for example. And often that is the only face or voice or idea of mixedness that you hear in the mainstream. So what I really wanted to do with my book is to open that conversation out, to really look at the huge variety and divergence that exists within mixedness, because there really isn't one singular story of multiraciality. There are so many nuances and different narratives within that often don't get heard, because frequently it's people who have my mix who are put to the front and presented as kind of the one voice of mixedness, but it's so much broader than that.
I mean, we talk about the opening synopsis that I gave, the preamble, as it were, says that you know, when you don't fit into a box that needs to be ticked, is that how you view yourself then, and others that you interviewed?
I think for myself, I view myself as a black woman and a mixed woman. So I think that both of those things can exist simultaneously. And I think it's important to not feel like you have to fit within a prescribed box. And I think that's where the difficulties come when I speak to people who are mixed. For the book, I spoke to more than 50 people of all different kinds of mixes, all different kinds of heritages. And obviously, they all have incredibly unique and fascinating individual stories. But also, there were definite threads that kind of tie our experiences together. And that kind of sense of existing in this in-between space, in these liminal spaces, and seeing life through this specific lens of in-betweenness, was something that came up again and again and again, regardless of what their heritage happened to be. So that is something that really unifies the mixed experience in the research that I've done. And that's an important thing. And I think that just really shows the need for not being so prescribed with where we want to put people. I think we have a tendency of wanting to neatly fit people in boxes, and the moment we can't fit them in, they become a problem. It becomes something that you can't understand, that you're uncomfortable with. And that's where we need to move away from. We need more acceptance for the people in between those boxes.
I mean, you know, Britain is, most of Europe now is becoming multicultural. I mean, Britain, obviously, we had the, you know, the Windrush generation. We had the collapse of the empire and people coming back from India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and whatever. And it creates that fabulous, and you go to somewhere like London and it is, you know, a sight to behold. What did you find in your research that the being mixed race, perhaps if you come from a traditional family, but be it Afro-Caribbean or be it, for example, from Indian, perhaps that if you are mixed race, following the traditions or the cultural identity of your family or of your nation can be a bit of a challenge as well. I'm thinking specifically sort of, you know, Indian, that sort of mixture.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very individual. I wouldn't want to make sweeping statements about people's experiences, but from the people that I've spoken to, I think that, you know, for mixed people, often those kind of traditions and cultural elements take on even more importance for them. And I found that often people will go out of their way to find those connections and forge those connections and make sure that they do have those links. Because I think sometimes when your heritage isn't 100% one thing or another, you can feel as though you don't necessarily have the same claim to those kind of traditions and cultures. You can feel like, okay, maybe I don't 100% fit in those spaces. So you almost end up making more effort to make them part of your life. And that's been a really positive thing in a lot of the people's lives that I've spoken to. And they found a lot of joy in kind of discovering that side of their culture and, you know, the minority side of their culture in the food and the traditions and, you know, all and the religion and all of the different elements that make up their family. And I think having the space to hold on to those traditions and discover that about that side of your family alongside potentially your British traditions if you live here and you're based here, that has been an amazing experience for people. It's something I've certainly found. I know I've over the years have made efforts to really connect with the Jamaican element of my heritage through getting to know wider family members and embracing Jamaican culture and the food, and that's something I really cherish.
Bring me up to speed on something, because I'm a mid-50s you know, white gentleman of advancing years. What is blackfishing? Excuse me. Am I completely out? I mean, I don't pretend to be down with the kids, obviously. But what is blackfishing, please?
Okay, so it's basically a spin on the term catfishing, which is where on like a dating app or something. Yeah, basically on a dating site, where you pretend to be something that you're not in order to get attention, to get dates. You basically lie, you put up a false picture. So blackfishing, which is a term that was coined by a writer, Serena, I forget her second name, but she's a writer. She wrote an article for Vice, and she coined this term. And it's essentially the phenomenon where influencers and people, young people on social media are essentially blacking up, for want of another term, in terms of their, you know, darkening their skin, they're wearing braids. It's essentially a form of cultural appropriation where people who are white are cherry picking elements of blackness and, you know, adding them to their appearance in order to suit their brand and to help them, you know, win clout on social media and followers. So yeah, and I think you mentioned before, but that is something that the Kardashians, for example, have been accused of a lot in the past.
Right then, and is that a help or a hindrance? Do you think, or do you think it's, you know, or do you think we just shouldn't be bothered with it?
Oh, it's definitely a hindrance. It's definitely a problematic thing that's happening. And yeah, and I think it's frustrating when you see people, again, cherry picking those parts of minority heritage that help them to progress but they don't have to live as a minority. They don't have to deal with any of the, you know, the disadvantageous elements of actually living as black or as this minority heritage person that they're kind of presenting themselves as. And they're kind of profiting off the aesthetics of racial ambiguity without having to actually experience racism or oppression or any of the, you know, the setbacks that people who are living as a minority have to deal with. And often those elements, you know, for example, the hairstyles, or all these cultural things that these social media influencers are kind of appropriating, they're things that have much more significant meaning to those communities, and they can't just be taken and used as a trend. And it's quite disrespectful. So I definitely think it's a damaging thing. It's not a good thing to be happening at all.
I mean, we had this, didn't we, about the braided hair a while back?
Yeah.
Because obviously a lot of people get it done on the beach, because I'm talking to you from the southern Spain, and we go all the way up to Mallorca and the islands and Ibiza. But it was a thing to have, you know, going all the way back to 10 and Bo Derek. But the, you know, the braided hair thing was seen as appropriation as well, and not helping.
Yeah, I mean, I think often it is appropriation. I think there's a tendency to over-exaggerate the importance of these kind of issues, which I think can be a distraction from, you know, the more pernicious forms of racism and issue. You know, a white woman braiding her hair isn't the biggest problem that black women are facing on a daily basis. So it's almost like, you know, we don't want to give it too much credence. We don't want to talk too much about it. But I don't think it's wrong for people to call it out and say that, you know, because these hairstyles they're protective hairstyles for people with Afro hair. There's a reason that black women wear their hair in those styles, and often we're persecuted for it. We're told that our hair looks unprofessional, unkempt, messy, dirty. We're told that we can't wear those styles in school, in work. And that makes black women's lives incredibly difficult a lot of the time. So to see it being repurposed by people like the Kardashians, by white influencers on social media, just feels like a bit of a slap in the face, because it's now so because white people have decided it's acceptable and trendy and cool, that kind of erases all the history that is steeped in those styles that people often don't realize.
We've been through a tumultuous period recently, obviously, what with the pandemic, and also, you know, Black Lives Matter as well. Has that, you know, and again, I'm being really careful when I phrase this, Natalie, so please bear with me. But I mean, has there been a situation where, you know, Black Lives Matter, black lives? I mean, do people of mixed race feel, have they been accused of not being black enough, or should, I mean, Black Lives Matter no matter what your mix is, in fact, no matter what your race is?
I think there's a tendency to assume that mixed people have been, that we experience the same level of hostility from both sides, as it were, but that's just not the case for myself or for anyone that I've spoken to. It's very much that minority communities and our elements of minority heritage have been, from what I've seen, overwhelmingly welcoming and accepting. And I think it's very rare for a person who is mixed with black to be shut out of those spaces, particularly at a time like now, and particularly if they're trying to add to the cause and help in an issue that is much, much bigger than whether a mixed race black person is black enough or not. So I don't think that has necessarily been an issue. I think maybe on an individual level, people who are mixed with black and with white heritage have had to ask themselves some questions about, you know, their own involvement in these systems where their privilege lies, have uncomfortable conversations with white family members, for example. And that is a different experience for sure. But overarchingly, I think the Black Lives Matter movement has been wholly inclusive and welcoming of everybody who is fighting for this much bigger, unified, vital cause that we all need to be behind. This isn't just, Black Lives Matter isn't a cause for only black people to care about. Black people, mixed race people, Asian people, white people all need to be shouting from the rooftops that Black Lives Matter. So I think that's, I think it's definitely been a hugely welcoming and inclusive movement.
When you finished all your interviews for this, and you interviewed over 40 people or 50 people for this, do you take a positive out of your research? Because it could be very easy to say that this is awful, but do you think, because there's been so much doomsaying with Brexit and BLM and all that stuff, did you leave when you finished this great book? Did you leave and thinking, you know, there is hope? This is the, you know, there is the melting pot, and this is the way that we can live together.
Absolutely. I mean, I think overarchingly, this is a very hopeful book, and the stories that I bring out from the people I interviewed are full of hope and joy and happiness and connection and love. And this isn't a kind of, a negative, look at how awful racism is, a kind of narrative. I mean, that is part of it, because inevitably, if you're living as a non-white person in Britain today, racism and oppression is part of that story, sadly. But there is so much more to that picture. And I think it's really important to look at the joys and, benefits that come with multiraciality and having kind of vast cultural influences within one family unit, and the acceptance and new understanding that can come from that. So yeah, I think it's definitely been a really positive experience for me, and yeah, it definitely gives me hope for the future. And to be honest, I'm just excited that these conversations are being had, and that can only give me hope for the future. This is the kind of book that I wish I had read when I was in my late teens, when I was struggling to come to terms with where I fit, who I was. This is the book that I needed to read. These are the experiences I needed to hear about. So if I can help somebody at that age get to, get their head around that earlier than I did, that could only be a positive, I think.
The book is called Mixed Other: Explorations of Multiraciality in Modern Britain. It's by Natalie Morris. Natalie, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, where can they go? Are you on social media? Is there a website? Are you on Twitter? Where can they find you?
I'm on Twitter, absolutely. I'm at nmoz, and it's the same on Instagram, which is at nmozz, so you can find me there.
We're talking about mixed races and whatever. One of my best friends is Swedish Cuban, and that is a mix and a half to have. I can tell you.
Wow!
But we get quite a few around here. And I'm just thinking of the great benefits. Some of my favourite music artists: Joy Crooks, Bangladeshi Irish, and Leanne LaHavis, yeah. Jamaican Greek. There's a huge benefits from this as well. The book is called Mixed Other: Explorations of Multiraciality in Modern Britain. It's by Natalie Morris. Natalie, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks.